This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
The PGA Tour is all systems go, and so is the new show, Early Wedge, on the CBS Sports Podcast Network. Join Sportsline experts Sia Nejad, Mike McClure, and Eric Cohen, alongside myself, Rick Gaiman, Patrick McDonald, and Jason Sobel. Five times per week, the Early Wedge provides the best information for DFS lineups, outright selections, and so much more. Follow and listen to Early Wedge in the Early Edge feed on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Rami Makhlouf on 670 The Score.
The Cubs are not in a rebuild. They sure do act like a mid-market team, or at least have been acting like a mid-market team throughout this offseason. And I like the Kyle Tucker trade, the Presley trade. I was drawing a blank on Presley for a second there, the closer they got from Houston. I like those moves, but there's no reason that you shouldn't be in on the likes of a Pete Alonso, or who he signed with the Mets today, a two-year deal, or Alex Bregman, who's still out there.
1 week later.
Breaking news coming down late Wednesday. Alex Bregman has signed a three-year, $120 million deal with the Boston Red Sox. It's being reported that Bregman turned down a six-year deal worth $170 million in favor of signing with Boston.
They're acting like a mid-market team.
Rami Makhlouf.
And baseball is just weird.
On 670 The Score in Odyssey Station.
Baseball is weird. I've been accused of being the same. Rami Makhlouf with you for the next 3 hours right here on Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score with Tyler Farengol on the other side of the glass, and a jam-packed show for you this evening. The voice of the Chicago Bulls, Chuck Swirsky, will join me at 7 o'clock to talk, well, Bulls. That's kind of what he does. That's his specialty. And Bob Nightingale of USA Today, their Major League Baseball columnist, he'll be here at 8 o'clock. I'm welcoming your text all night long at 312-644-6767. I am live from the Hyundai Score Studios, brought to you by your local Hyundai dealers. I'll get into some Bears talk a little later this hour as well. But, and like I said, your texts are welcome at 312-644-6767. I know that Cubs-Dodgers series wrapped up a couple days ago, and they're back stateside and playing spring training baseball again, which is weird. But this is my first chance to get on the airwaves and kind of give my thoughts on it. And your thoughts welcome at 312-644-6767. And I know I'm not the only one who felt this way watching that game. I know that because I caught Mullion Haw the day after, and I was listening to Spiegel and Holmes, and Holmes was talking about a text that he got from Nick Friedel, who was at the games in Tokyo, and he expressed a similar sentiment. Did that Cubs series just feel too familiar? 312-644-6767 if you want to shoot me a text. Because, and I know Mullion Haw said it felt like they were watching games 163 and 164 of the 2024 season as they were watching that. And that's a great way to sort of encapsulate what it felt like watching those two baseball games. Just four runs across the plate in two games for the Cubs. And between the two games, they go 2-for-14 with runners in scoring position and slug just three extra base hits, all doubles, only one with a runner on base. Wednesday, they drew seven walks. If I told you a baseball team drew seven walks, they probably won that game. Or at least put up enough runs to be in that game. They failed to cash in on any of those. Seven walks, not one of those guys crosses the plate. And I'm watching that, And I'm absorbing it after the fact, and I'm going, man, that felt really, really familiar. And I looked at last season, the Cubs were 21st in isolated slugging at 151. And even what Craig Counsell said after the game felt familiar. Here was Craig Counsell after that series in Tokyo on his offense.
I think we did a better job tonight. I think offensively we had, you know, pressure, especially innings like... really, innings 2 through 5, I thought we put quality pressure in 9. So we put pretty good pressure on them. You know, we hit six singles, they hit six extra base hits. And that's kind of the difference tonight. Our base hits, they did damage with their hits. We had traffic, we're missing that damage hit to kind of put some runs on the board.
Wasn't that the story last year in a lot of the Cubs losses? And look, it's not all gloom and doom after that series, and I'm not hitting the panic button. It is just two games, and some of the stuff they did in the offseason, it showed. Like, we saw that bullpen, that improved bullpen, the fruits of their labor and money spent showing a little bit outside of the Ben Brown appearance, but I'm not out on Ben Brown by any means after one appearance in a game in Tokyo under those circumstances. It wasn't normal circumstances. I do want to talk about that coming up in just a little bit. So some of the things that they did to improve this team in the offseason really, really showed themselves in those two games. But the offense, like, look, the bullpen was the main problem last year. I've said on this station, I asked Andy Martinez a couple weeks ago from Marquee when I was last here, if it's simplifying things too much to say, well, if they can convert half of the 26 saves that they blew last year, then they should win this division. And Andy said that's not simplifying it too much. And if they can do that or even better, then yeah, this should be a much improved baseball team. And that's true. That is true. But in thinking about this, thinking about what I saw last season and then what I saw in those first two games, I remembered a conversation that I had had with my brother and some other Cubs fans as they were going through their early season struggles last year. And we were all focused on the bullpen. And rightly so. You don't blow 26 saves. Like, that's just not acceptable. But I made the point then, and I might have made the point on the air, but I just remembered this conversation specifically, that you're making it real hard on your bullpen because you don't score enough runs. And you're sending them out there to protect one-run leads every time because you can't score more than four runs in a baseball game. And holding a one-run lead for two, three, four innings sometimes in the game of baseball today, that's a hard thing to do. And we're going to point the finger at the guy who's standing on the mound when those one or even two-run leads dissolve and you're watching the other team celebrate and dap up at the end of the baseball game and you're going home with another L. But the offense fed into the bullpen, and the bullpen fed into the offense. They were both feeling the pressure that the other was putting on them. The batters were feeling the pressure of, oh my God, if we don't score eight runs, we're probably going to lose this baseball game. And the bullpen, every time they went in, they were feeling the pressure of, oh my God, me and the rest of the guys in the bullpen here, we got to protect a one or two run lead for three or four innings. That's a lot to ask. And I don't want either of those units, the offense or the bullpen, to be put in that position again this year. And so I got these thoughts bouncing around in my head about how familiar those two games in Tokyo against the Dodgers felt to me. And I'm sure they felt familiar to some of you out there as well. Welcome your thoughts on the text line at 414-677-1250 if you want to get in. And then while I'm having these thoughts, I'm doing some show prep, getting ready for the show today, and I come across the Athletic's tiers of position players, their top 100 position players, and how they stack up. I heard Spiegel and Holmes yesterday talking about their tiers of position players. Well, they put out their tiers they were talking about tiers of pitchers. They put out their tiers of position players today, and they break them down into, and it's a lot. Spiegel, when he was breaking down the pitcher tiers yesterday, said it's clunky. This is probably clunkier, but I'm going to simplify it. I'm going to break it down to the things we actually care about when it comes to this conversation in just a second. So stick with me here for a sec. There's six tiers: are best of the best, MVP contenders, all stars, steady and solid, 30 something regulars, and then 20 something regulars. I'm just gonna go by number. Tier one, best. Tier six, worst. Of the top 100 players in the league, tier one are the best of the best. Tier six are the guys at the bottom of that 100 and that 20 something regulars tier that they talk about. And I'm going through this And I go past tier one. I get the best of the best. You know, I get to tier two and I get to MVP contenders. And there's Kyle Tucker. Great pickup. Kyle Tucker, great pickup. And the fact that you have somebody on the roster now who can be put into a tier of MVP contenders, which they describe as just a half step down from the top. And they say there's a level for greatness. So you have a great player in Kyle Tucker. First time in a long time, I think Cubs fans have been able to say that. I'm happy about that. But you keep going down this list, down these tiers. And I got to go all the way to tier four, which encapsulates the top 60 players in Major League Baseball. I got to go all the way to tier four and the steady and solid category to get to the next Cub, Dansby Swanson. Then it picks up a little bit. You got two guys, Ian Happ and Seiya Suzuki in tier five. And you got a couple, you got Nico Horner in tier six, and that's it. So the top 100 players, the Cubs have six of them. I guess that's not, it's not a terrible number, but you have two players in the top four tiers. The top 60 players in Major League Baseball among position players. And when I frame it that way, I don't know that we should really expect this offense to be very, very good or a lot better than what we saw last season, even with the addition of a Kyle Tucker. And I heard a lot with Kyle Tucker this year and then Justin Turner, who they added just before spring training started when they missed out on the Alex Bregman sweepstakes. Oh, we got all these guys. And they said about Ryan Pressly, too, out of the bullpen. We got all these guys with October experience. And that's gonna come up big for us. These guys, they know how to play in October. They understand the pressure. They understand the situation of October baseball. These are guys that are battle tested and have been through it. I'm not dismissing that. I'm not saying that's not a good thing to have. But are we sure we're not getting out over our skates or out over our skis here? That's the expression, right? Out over our skis. Are we sure we're not getting a little out over our skis here when we talk about how good these guys are in October, how good these guys are even in September and in big pressure situations? Because I think one thing that's left out when you make that point that you have all these players with all this experience and big games and everything else, is that Kyle Tucker, Justin Turner, Ryan Pressly, they were surrounded by other very good players who helped get them to October, who made pitchers throw better pitches at them. The reason Kyle Tucker saw the pitches that he saw any pitches at all, for that matter, in the month of October, is because he was on a very good team. And that doesn't take anything away from Kyle Tucker when I say that. That's the nature of baseball. Just look at that Dodgers team that we just saw. And they talked about it a lot on the call on FS1 about the effect that every guy in that lineup has on the other guys in that lineup in a number of ways. In terms of just how good they are and knowing, man, if I get through this all-star, there's another all-star waiting on deck to try and put one over the fence. The pressure of having guys on base and knowing you have to make a perfect pitch or it could mean a run or two. The cohesiveness of that lineup where you see Shohei Ohtani score a run and as he's coming off the field, he pulls aside Kike Hernandez and tells him something that he noticed in the pitcher's delivery. That's a lineup that puts a lot of pressure on you in a lot of ways. And that's how good teams, that's how good lineups are made up. And if I was talking to you in Cleveland right now or Milwaukee or Tampa Bay or Pittsburgh, any of those, I'd understand why you only have two players in the top four tiers, the top 60 players of Major League Baseball. This is Chicago. This is the Cubs. This is a big market, man. And as I watch those two games, and it feels so familiar to me, I can't help, and again, not setting off the panic alarms, not it's not all gloom and doom. There's 160 games left, and this is a better baseball team than what they had last year. But is Kyle Tucker really going to fix the issues that this offense had last year all by himself? Because I look at that Cubs lineup, and that's really the only change. Unless we're counting on Matt Shaw to be rookie of the year and help carry this offense along with Kyle Tucker, or a breakout season from Pete Crow Armstrong to build on what he did at the end of last year. That's asking a lot of those guys. And I don't know that you can put that on those guys or count on that or count on getting that out of those guys for your success this year. Or maybe Miguel Amaya can build on what he did in the second half last year. There's a lot of maybes and a lot of ifs in this Cubs lineup. I would like to see more sure things. And it's too late now. This conversation might be kind of pointless right now. Maybe this is just stuff I needed to get off my chest after watching those two games, and it felt so familiar. But it, for some reason, just dawned on me in the aftermath of that series that Kyle Tucker was the only major change to this lineup. And I don't know if they expect him to single-handedly change the whole complexion of the lineup and change how pitching staffs attack them, but sure didn't feel that way as you scratched across four runs over the course of two games and went 2-for-14 with runners in scoring position and had three extra base hits, only one with a runner on base, and not one ball left the ballpark. Kyle Tucker's not hitting in that Astros lineup that he was for the entirety of his career to this point, where he was very well protected. And again, that doesn't take anything away from Kyle Tucker. That's baseball. That's how the game is played. And in this lineup, he simply doesn't have that. This isn't a lineup that strikes fear into opposing pitching staffs. So I think the Cubs' formula for winning this year is slight improvement on offense with Kyle Tucker being in there. And then, as I said when I started this whole thing, maybe the bullpen is improved to some degree. Well, it is improved. And you'll be able to protect those small leads better than you were able to protect those small leads in last season's disappointment. But man, it sure would have been nice if you could have added just one other guy in those top three or four tiers to make this lineup a little bit more intimidating. To have two guys in the top 60, again, for the Chicago Cubs, if I go through this list and go through those top three tiers, you know what I'm seeing? Obviously a lot of Dodgers, a lot of Mets, but also a lot of Braves, a lot of Phillies. Those aren't like huge markets or teams with the deepest pockets. Those are just teams that are trying harder to win than you are, flat out. Those are just teams that are trying to win harder than you are right now. Got a text here that says they're 12th in payroll. That is not a team that is trying. They rank 12 in total payroll. That's not doing everything you can to win a World Series. And that's true. Can't argue with that. Did that series, that Tokyo series, feel just a little too familiar to you? You can get in on the show, 312-644-6767, if you want to shoot me a text, want to talk about that with you. Also, and like I said, I'll get into some Bears talk a little later this. I had an epiphany when it comes to the Chicago Bears and what they should do in the draft. That's coming up at about 640. But speaking of that Tokyo series, I think I might just be a wet blanket after this, which wouldn't be the first time, but I might just be a wet blanket after this. The Cubs take on the Rockies tomorrow in Cactus League action. Speaking of the Cubs, from Sloan Park in Mesa, Zach Zaidman and Ron Coomer will be on the call starting at 2:55. Cubs spring training games on the Score are sponsored by Sloan, the leader in smart water and commercial restroom solutions. We'll hit a quick break. On the other side, I'll read some of your texts about that opening series. Did it feel just a little too familiar? 312-644-6767. Tyler Farengel on the other side of the glass. Did I give out the wrong phone numbers? Did you catch me? Get somebody texted. Make sure you give out the right phone numbers. It wouldn't be the first time. Did you catch it?
I did not catch it, but
okay.
I'll be a little bit more. 312-644-6767. You got that, that's where you can text us.
That is the correct number to text the show if you want to get in. I do some work for our sister station in Milwaukee, The Fan, as well. Don't fear not. I'm a Chicagoan through and through. Bears fan, Cubs fan, Bulls fan, just like you guys. But I do some work for them, and every time I'm on there, I give out the wrong numbers, and occasionally it might happen here as well. If I did it, I'm sorry, and I'll try to be better in the future. Did that Cubs series feel just a little too familiar to you? 312-644-6767 is the number if you want to call. Rami Makhlouf with you on the Score right here on a Friday evening.
This feels totally different. Just a different level of excitement, different level of hype. Yeah, obviously those games were sold out and there was excitement around. We had, you know, Daisuke Matsuzaka and Hideki Okajima, but not the same as this. This is the next level, and it's been a lot of fun to watch.
There's Cubs president of baseball operations, Jed Hoyer, talking about their series in Tokyo against the Dodgers, which just felt awfully familiar to me. The way that they lost those games. Also, he was talking about the experience of playing those games over in Japan. I want to talk about that in a second, and I might be the wet blanket when it comes to that particular subject. But wanted to read some of your texts. You can keep them coming at 312-644-6767. Like I said, it just felt a lot like last year, watching that Cubs game scratch across just four runs in two games and go just 2-for-14 with runners in scoring position and three extra base hits, just one with a runner on base. That felt like the 2024 Cubs, or as Mullion Haw put it, it felt like games 163 and 164 of the 2024 Cubs. And that just, it left a bad taste in my mouth. No panic alarms, not saying that they can't improve on last year. Just it set in for me that the only real change to that lineup this year was Kyle Tucker. Significant change, but the only real change was Kyle Tucker. And adding Kyle Tucker gave the Cubs two players in the Athletics' top four tiers of position players, top 60. And that's just not, if you have two position players in the top 60, you're not striking a lot of fear into the opposing team's pitching staff, even with the Kyle Tucker in the middle of it. You need somebody somewhere around Kyle Tucker that also strikes some fear, and those guys were out there in free agency, and the Cubs just chose to sort of sit out those sweepstakes. Here's a text from the 779. What I keep trying to tell myself is that the bullpen blew 15 to 20 games in April and May last year before we actually got it figured out. And by then, we were in too big of a hole to climb out of. I feel like Jed did a decent job at rebuilding the bullpen this year. Hopefully, that will be the difference. Like I said, I think that's what the Cubs are counting on to be the difference. A slightly improved offense. They can get you, squeeze out maybe just a couple more runs over the course of a season. I don't mean just a couple over the course of a season, but I'm just saying a few more runs over the course of a season, and then that bullpen with a lighter workload, less pressure put on them to have to protect a one or two run lead every day, and just the improved talent, the arms that they added to that bullpen, that will be enough. And I'm sorry, but I don't know that's the best formula for winning baseball games. You're still going to put a lot of pressure on that bullpen with the lineup that you run out there every day. From the 630, all we have to do is compare the 2016 lineup to this lineup. We won our World Series. Now Ricketts is fine with just winning a division. Feels that way. Says, who is now our Rizzo, Bryant, Fowler, Zobrist, Schwarber? Tucker. And I don't say that to discredit or demean any of the other guys in that lineup. They're just not that kind of hitter or that kind of player. Yeah, when you look at that 2016 World Series team, he just reeled off four guys that in one way, shape, or form struck some fear into the opposing team's pitching staff. Whether it was Dexter Fowler getting on base and wreaking havoc, or it was, you know, the power of Rizzo and Bryant and Schwarber. every batter, the pitcher had to be on his A game, or that could be the game. Can you say that when you're looking at a lineup of Hap, Suzuki, Tucker, Bush, Shaw, Swanson, Armstrong? That doesn't strike fear in me if I'm an opposing pitcher. From the 779, we had another guy and we decided to be cheap and trade him to the Yankees because we didn't want to pay him. The Cubs strategy year over year is hope. Hoping players outperform their projections. Well, to take a page out of Jed's book, hope they get it together and bring in Vladimir Guerrero Jr., versatile, young, and will be a beast in the lineup at Wrigley. That would be nice if you could add a Vladimir Guerrero Jr. And I know that means probably David Shaw is headed to Toronto, and I'm okay with that. To go and get a bona fide slugger and bat in the middle of your lineup like a Vladimir Guerrero Jr., that's the type of lineup. If you have Kyle Tucker and Vladimir Guerrero Jr. in the middle of your lineup, you don't have, you will have occasionally, but you won't as frequently as you did last year and the way you started this year, have these types of series where you can't get a guy across the plate, even with 14 guys getting into scoring position over the course of two games, you can't scratch somebody across the plate. That's what you need. Someone being very rational from the 815. It's too quick to judge. They were playing the World Series champs. Yeah, that's the level I want to get to. It is too quick to judge. But I'm not going to sit here and go, well, they're better. That's the problem. Yes, they are the World Series champs because they put together a World Series lineup and a World Series roster. This is like when I talk about the Bears and people go, well, they're in a tough division. I know. Be better. Be better than those teams in your division. That's the job, is to be better. That's the nature of sports and competition. You don't just fold up and go, well, they were playing a really good team. The competition is tough. Obviously. And you're supposed to try and be better than them. Are the Cubs trying to be better than the Dodgers? Are they really trying to be better than the Dodgers? And I'm not saying they can spend as much as the Dodgers, but are they really trying to be as good or better than the Dodgers? Or are they just sitting there and going, well, they are the champs, like that text from the 815. Not to insult you, but I hate it when people use that argument or excuse. I heard it all year when I would compare the Bears to the other teams in the rest of the division. And people would go, well, it is the best division in football. With no help from the Chicago Bears. I'm not just going to fold my hands and go, well, that's a better team. That's the problem, is that they're a better team. One more text, and then I want to talk about that Tokyo series, the spectacle of it. This from Samir. From Chicago here. So did anyone see the Cubs website comment saying the amped Tokyo environment will prepare the Cubs for a playoff run? What kind of nonsense is that? And that leads me right into what I wanted to talk about with this Japan series. I'm going to start this off with a disclaimer, okay? I get the novelty of it. I do. And for a lot of people involved, the novel, you heard Jed Hoyer talking about the experience and how exciting it was. And it's got to be very, very cool for the contingency of Japanese players to go back and get the love and the praise and the electricity, everything that came with it. That was very cool to watch those guys be celebrated. And I understand that. And we are a partner of the Chicago Cubs. And we got some benefits too from the uniqueness and the spectacle of this series in Japan. Okay? And I know I'm about to be a wet blanket here. Disclaimer out of the way. I don't want to get up at 5 a.m. to watch baseball, man. Or any other sport. I'm sorry. I don't want to wake up that early. I'm not a morning guy. I'm not setting my alarm for 4:30 a.m. The last time the Cubs played in Japan, and Jed referred back to that when they had Daisuke Matsuzaka and those players. I was living in Madison, Wisconsin. I was in college, and I bought into the hype. I was like, "This is awesome! They're playing in Japan. This is great." Can't wait to wake up and watch this game at 4 a.m. or 5 a.m. or whatever it was at the time. I got up. I made pancakes. I got up early enough to make pancakes before first pitch. They were chocolate chip, I remember. And I sat down in front of my TV and woke up in the, I don't know, it was the sixth or the seventh inning with like one bite taken out of my pancakes. And then I was out. I can't do it. I can't get up that early to watch any sport. I hate it when they play these NFL games overseas and I got to get up at 7 a.m. on a Sunday to watch the Bears. I hate it. I don't like it. And beyond that, beyond just the fact that you did most of your fans a disservice by having opening day at 5 a.m., in my opinion. I don't think most people want to get up at 4 or 5 a.m. to watch a game. And they probably can't even finish watching the game because they got to go to work. But beyond the fact that I feel like having the game at that time of day is kind of a disservice to your fans who want to see. Oh, I love opening day. Like, I set aside time. I take time off from work and make plans to go and watch opening day. It's at 5 a.m. I couldn't do that. But beyond that, and again, I know I'm the wet blanket on this, and I'll prove it in a second, all right? It wasn't good for the team. From a baseball standpoint, it wasn't good for the Cubs. Maybe not even for the Dodgers, but I don't care about the Dodgers. I'm here to talk to you about the Cubs. Baseball players, maybe more than any sport, are creatures of habit and routine. They thrive on it. This threw a whole wrench in spring training. They're back in Mesa playing spring training games now? That's weird for me. How weird has that got to be for the players to go and play meaningful games someplace where it's tomorrow, today somehow? I don't really understand time differences. And now you got to come back and play spring training games and then rev it up again for the real thing next week? It's weird. It's weird. It messed with all these guys' routines, I would imagine. I haven't heard any of them complain. I don't think they would. But I got to imagine that was a wrench in most players' spring training routines to fly across the world with a week left in spring training, and then come back and get back into spring mode and then rev the engines back up for the regular season in a week. It's weird. It's weird, and it messes with routines in a sport where players thrive on routine and habit. And now, after, you know, usually you have an opening series and you face the opposing team's aces, and then in the second series, you'll get the back half of a rotation because they threw their aces in whatever series they just played against whatever opponent they might have had on the schedule to start the season. Now you go from facing the Dodgers aces, which you could argue are as good as anybody in the league, and you have to come back, and next week you're going to face Zach Gallen and Corbin Burns back-to-back, which, by the way, just starts a brutal start to the schedule for the Chicago Cubs. They're going to open with the D-backs next week. Little break with the minor league A's. But then you got San Diego, the Rangers, Dodgers again, Padres, D-backs, Dodgers, Phillies. And then you close the month with the Pirates at the end of April. That is an absolutely brutal schedule in any normal year. In just any normal season, you'd look at that and go, whew, that's a slog right there in April. If you can get through that at 500, you're doing good. But to ask these guys to go across the world, play games in what is the middle of the night here, and then come back here and do spring training again, and then go face two aces again, and then go play that schedule, that's daunting, man. And I know Craig Counsell and all the players, they had nothing but good things to say about the trip to Tokyo, and they didn't seem too upset about it. But I got to imagine some of those guys are like, man, this is rough. But apparently I'm the only one. Apparently I'm the only one who didn't care for it, and I'm willing to admit that, because the league said today that the Tokyo series opener drew an average of more than 25 million viewers across all platforms, making it the most watched MLB game ever in Japan. The total surpassed a previous mark of 18.7 million set during the 2024 Seoul series. They also said the two-game Tokyo series averaged more than 24 million viewers, eclipsing the 2024 Seoul series by nearly 7 million to become the most watched MLB series ever in Japan. The Tokyo series recorded the best merchandise sales of any MLB international event in history, with sales eclipsing the previous mark from the 2024 London series by 320%. So obviously, a lot of people enjoyed it. They said it drew more than 450,000 people over the course of 12 days and was the most visited MLB fan festival in league history. So I'm willing to admit here, I'm the oddball. I'm the wet blanket. I'm in the minority on all this. And apparently I'm lazy. 24 million of you woke up to watch baseball at 5 a.m.? That's good for you, man. Y'all are getting out there and getting it at the crack of dawn with the crow of the rooster. Y'all are up and getting you some baseball. And that's great. This text from the 708, the 5 a.m. game almost got me fired. Another one from the 708. You're absolutely right. The Cubs tried to be slightly better than the teams in their bad division. Nothing else. Going back to what I was saying earlier. And here's a text, which is a good question. Okay, but what were the ratings in America? I don't know. They just gave me the overall ratings. So I don't have an answer to that question. But a lot of people enjoyed it. And it wouldn't be the first time that a lot of people were having a good time and I was off in the corner going, I don't like this. And I'll admit when I'm that guy. And maybe I'm being that guy right now, but I don't care. And it's all just, this is the last thing I'm going to say on it. It's just a money grab. Like, the only reason any of these leagues play these games overseas is to expand into new markets and tap into some money. It doesn't do a thing to make baseball better for me or you, the U.S. fan. And I'm not trying to be like America first. I'm just saying, like, this is simply for the Cubs, the Dodgers, and Major League Baseball to expand their fan base and get into a few more pockets. And I'm sorry, but I'm not happy about waking up at 5 a.m. so that the already rich Major League Baseball and its owners can get even richer. We'll hit a quick break. On the other side, I've come to a conclusion. I've had an epiphany when it comes to what the Bears should do in the NFL draft. I'll talk about that right after this. Rami Makhlouf with you. It's the Score Evening Show on a Friday night right here on Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score.
We're back live with more Rami Makhlouf on 670 The Score in Odyssey Station.
Meet Dustin Rhodes in 670 The Score tomorrow from 2 to 4 p.m. at AT&T in Oaklawn. Stop by to enter for a chance to win tickets to see the Bulls take on the Lakers March 27th. Plus, you can meet Chicago legend Will Perdue and the Incredibles Entertainment Squad. That's tomorrow from 2 to 4 p.m. at AT&T in Oak Lawn at 5251 West 95th Street. I'll be joined by the voice of the Bulls, Chuck Swirsky, coming up here in just a few minutes at 7 o'clock. A couple texts came in on the whole Japan thing and me being a sourpuss about the whole Japan thing, even though it was one of the more popular events that baseball has put out there in a while. This text came in from J-Mo. He says, how about soccer fans that have to get up at the crack of ass to watch regularly? This may screw up the Cubs for 3 weeks. Asian jet lag is real. Guess what? One of the reasons I don't watch soccer is because I have to get up in the... Other than the fact it's just an incredibly boring sport, I'm not getting up... Can you imagine getting up at 3 or 4 a.m. and then trying to stay awake watching soccer? I can't watch soccer with a full night's sleep, much less at 3 or 4 a.m. Somebody corrected me. The Cubs back in 2000 or 2001, they didn't play in Japan. I said I got up to watch them in Japan. They were in Seoul, South Korea, and then this text from the 708. I was super psyched at 4 a.m. for game one. Then I slept through AM entire day of work. So it didn't help productivity at all either in the Chicagoland area, I would imagine. A lot of tired people checking in at the office or the factory for work on Tuesday and Wednesday. Yeah, I don't know, man. I guess it wasn't for me. And if you're one of the other people who felt the way I did, it wasn't for you either. Not everything is for us. You know what I mean? So let's just leave it at that. I did want to talk. I said before the break, I had an epiphany. I've come to a decision on what I want the Bears to do at number 10, and it's something that's picked up a lot of steam since they've done what they've done in the offseason of addressing the middle of the offensive line with a couple trades and the free agent signing of Dahlman. And I didn't think, especially after they made those signings, I kind of sat back and went, you know what? I don't know that they could really disappoint me with whatever they do at number 10. I don't know that they could really disappoint me. Almost any player that they take there is probably going to be pretty good and is going to help them out. If they you know, are smart about picking and don't completely whiff on it, you should get a player that helps you there at number 10. But I've moved off that very reasonable position that I was taking with what they should do at number 10. And at this point, I'm all in on Ashton Jeanty, man. I'm going to be disappointed, and I probably shouldn't approach the draft this way. It's probably, I'm going to admit, it's probably not the most logical, reasonable, level-headed take I've ever had, but I think I've got my heart set on Ashton Jeanty there at number 10, if he's still available. And I was thinking, why not Ashton Jeanty before they even addressed the offensive line? I was looking at him going, if that guy slips to you at 10, you got to think about it. Even if you haven't addressed the offensive line fully and sufficiently yet, that's a player that you got to think about. And then the more that I read leading up to the draft, and the more I hear and listen to people talk about Ashton Jeanty and what the Bears should do in the draft, the more and more convinced I become that this is the guy. And one of the people doing a lot of the heavy lifting and convincing me is Adam Johns over at The Athletic, covers the Bears for them. And he had two pieces recently where he makes the case for Ashton Jeanty. And I wanted to bring it to you. Some of these are points that I brought up when I brought up the possibility of Ashton Jeanty in the past, before I got my heart 100% set and I was all in on taking the running back out of Boise State. I've made some of these points, but Adam, in his brilliance, as he does with the written word, maybe makes the point a little better and a little clearer than me. So it's time for a portion of the show that we like to call Rami Reads. This is Adam Johns in a couple of different pieces he's had recently talking about Ashton Jeanty and why it's somebody that the Bears should consider. He said, it's a deep year for running backs and tight ends, but that doesn't mean you should wait to add one. Taking the best running back in a good year for the position says more about what you're adding as opposed to taking the third best offensive lineman at number 10. And that's a great point by Adam. That is one I have not made, because some of the pushback that you get on taking an Ashton Jeanty is, man, it's a deep year for running backs. You don't need to do that. You don't need to reach for this guy at number 10 in a deep year for running backs. But if in a deep year for running backs, you're getting the best of that class, that says something about that guy and what you're getting. Are you getting the best offensive lineman? Are you getting the best pass rusher at a position if you go with one of those two? I don't think you are. Then he goes on to say, the Bears need true difference makers who impact the game, as Poles said. Jeanty or Warren should be able to do that immediately, especially in Johnson's offense. This is a great point. He says it's worth repeating what Lions general manager Brad Holmes said after drafting running back Jahmyr Gibbs 2 years ago at number 12. Quote, we didn't acquire a running back in the first round. We acquired an elite weapon to keep our offense explosive in the first round. Jeanty and Warren are both elite weapons. Both of those last two points that he made there, that they need true difference makers who impact the game. That's something I've been saying since the season ended. And whether it was at running back or tight end or pass rusher or going and getting like a nasty tone setter of an offensive lineman, I was saying they need impact difference makers since this season ended. More than any one particular position, that's what they need. And I've also been saying for years now, I remember going back to Michael Vick debates with people and them arguing his qualifications as a quarterback as he was revolutionizing the position. I'd go, man, don't just look at him as a quarterback. He's a weapon who's dangerous from anywhere on the field to strike with his arms or his legs. And when I see a guy like that, I forget position. I know it's not a positionless sport like basketball has become, but when you're talking about a guy who has that kind of talent and that kind of potential to flip a game on its head in one play, I don't care what position it's at, and I don't care what other holes you might have. You go and do that. And then just one more quick excerpt. This was from the Athletics beat writer mock draft that they did, and at number 10, Adam Johns picking for the Chicago Bears, he takes, not surprisingly after that previous piece I read to you, Ashton Jeanty. And this is why. He says, Coach Ben Johnson has been very complimentary of veteran DeAndre Swift, but the Bears are in no position to pass on a blue-chip player in their current state. Regardless of their other roster needs and the value of other positions, give me Genty over the third-best offensive lineman and pass rushers who requires some projection because of their lackluster production in college or are undersized. In Genty, the Bears add an elite difference-making weapon for Johnson's offense. The Lions did the same when running back Jahmyr Gibbs was drafted at number 12 2 years ago. Johnson will remember that. His offense in Detroit changed because of it. Genty could have the same impact with the Bears, so give me the potential star in Genty. There is no such thing as a sure thing in the NFL draft. I think if Ashton Genty slips to you at number 10, he's more of a sure thing than anything that you're going to get, and he's that blue-chip, impact, difference-maker type of player that this Bears team desperately needs. They need it on both sides of the ball. I don't think you're going to find that type of defensive player at number 10. If Ashton Genty slips to you at number 10, you have potentially that type of player, and I don't think you pass up on him. I'm all in on Ashton Genty. I'm not the only one, though. If you don't trust me, if you're like, who is this Jamoke? Who is he does an evening shift once a week? He's sold on Ashton Genty. Who is this guy telling me? Well, you'll hear from smarter people than me. I don't mind admitting that. You'll hear from smarter people than me who are in on Ashton Genty. We'll bring you that at about 7:25 after I talk with the voice of the Chicago Bulls, Chuck Swirsky, who joins me, Rami Makhlouf, on the Score Evening Show right after this on Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score.